We're hoping that we can sign by the 23rd of March. Now, if it's two days after, one day before, a week after, it doesn't matter. But we are using that deadline to try to comply with it, because, and we are both committed, and the good part is that we're both enthusiastic about trying to sign by the 23rd of March.
Welcome to the WOLA podcast, Latin America Today. I'm Adam Isaacson.
And I'm Sarah Kanosian.
That was the president of Colombia, Juan Manuel Santos, back on February 3rd during his visit to Washington. NPR's Tom Gelton had just asked him whether Colombia would reach a final peace accord with the FARC guerrillas by a deadline of March 23rd. That's the date that President Santos had set in a very public forum during a historic meeting with the FARC back in September.
Well, March 23rd is come and gone, and Colombia did not reach that final accord. A 52-year-old conflict between Colombia's government and the FARC guerrilla group, going back to 1964 with 220,000 people killed, is still officially unresolved, even if it's happening at a very low intensity right now. It turns out that the date they set was too ambitious. There was too much ground still left to cover in those 6 months. That's not surprising, really. But still, we here at WOLA had some hope that the negotiators in Havana would have reached agreement on something less ambitious, but still important, a bilateral ceasefire. Even if there were other topics left to discuss at the table, the ceasefire on its own would have been a great achievement, perhaps great enough to have deserved a photo and visit from President Obama during his historic trip to Cuba. Instead, the negotiators got separate visits from Secretary of State John Kerry.
But the Obama photo didn't happen. There's still no official bilateral ceasefire. On the evening of March 23rd, the lead negotiator for the Colombian government, Humberto de la Calle, had to get up in front of the microphones and say that the parties are still too far apart, even to get to a ceasefire, much less the final accord that President Santos had promised back in September. Now, the FARC are observing a unilateral ceasefire on their own, and in fact, there's been almost no combat between the FARC's 7,000 fighters and government forces really since last July. But getting to beyond that, to a full cessation of hostilities, is something else. Not only does that mean that the government pledges not to attack the guerrillas, which it mostly hasn't, it also means the guerrillas not only have to stop attacking targets, but they would have to stop extorting money. They'd have to stop recruiting fighters, laying landmines, and probably even stop narco trafficking. It would also mean that, thanks to a Security Council resolution passed in January, a UN mission would come into the country with 350 unarmed foreign military personnel ready to investigate any violations of the ceasefire. And it means that guerrillas will have to concentrate themselves in specific areas around the country, demilitarized zones where they can live out in the open as they prepare to disarm. These concentration zones would be all over Colombia. They would be both for the guerrillas' own protection as they disarm, which would make them more vulnerable to possible attacks, but also as a way to guarantee that the guerrillas themselves aren't cheating on their own commitments. What those specific areas, that they're calling them zonas de concentración or concentration zones in Colombia, what they'll look like is the biggest issue that the talks are hung up on right now. It's why we don't have an accord on a ceasefire. How many of these zones will there be? How big will they be? Will they be entire counties, or will they just be the size of farms? Will they have towns inside of them with existing populations? Will guerrilla leaders be able to come and go from them as they please? None of these questions are settled yet, and that's why the negotiators didn't announce anything.
This is a genuinely hard issue, and it's going to take more face-to-face negotiation at the table in Havana. But nearly every expert or official whom we've consulted is certain that a final peace accord will happen this year and that a ceasefire is coming much sooner, probably in a matter of weeks. Once there's a ceasefire, even if there are still issues left to deal with at the table in Havana, the FARC, after 52 years, will stop being a national organization that controls territory through violence. So let's imagine that a real bilateral cessation of hostilities is signed. What happens next? First, the UN has 30 days to figure out exactly how and where its verification mission will work and report back to the Secretary General. Then, it has to set itself up very quickly. More or less, at the same time, all 7,000 FARC guerrillas, plus probably a similar or larger number of urban militias and support personnel, for a total that could number up to 20,000, will have to report to these concentration zones.
Now, this UN mission is not going to be a UN peacekeeping mission. It's an unarmed verification mission. That means when guerrillas leave aside weapons and start demobilizing, there will be no sort of blue-helmeted international soldiers arrayed there to protect them. The guerrillas' protection will be entirely up to their longtime enemies, the Colombian armed forces. Ariel Avila of the Peace and Reconciliation Foundation in Bogota says that protecting guerrillas instead of fighting them will require a big change in thinking for Colombia's military.
These armed forces, an institution the president has said is not up for negotiation, it is they who have to take care of the guerrillas, and those who have to take care of the people and the FARC based on social and political stances. So there has to be a change in doctrine. It can't continue being the same.
Another big issue is the people who happen to already be living in the concentration zones where FARC will be gathering. The government would prefer that the FARC be concentrated into a series of empty, uninhabited areas in the far-off parts of the country, like jungle camps or something. But the government is unlikely to get that. Still, it will be very hard for the government to stomach the idea of pulling the military and police out of these zones, leaving the security of people in towns who live there already, leaving their security up to a guerrilla group that hasn't fully disarmed yet. One government proposal to protect these existing communities is the formation of independent community police forces, but we're not sure where that idea stands right now in the negotiations.
Another very important kind of already existing communities are Afro-Colombian and indigenous territories. A lot of the armed conflict, especially in the past 10 years or so, has been fought in areas that, according to Colombian law, are the property of indigenous groups, indigenous reserves, or the communal property of traditional Afro-Colombian communities, called community councils. It's likely that some of the FARC concentration zones may be established right in the middle of these Afro-Colombian indigenous territories. Most of these communities say that while they're happy to help consolidate peace, they're also worried about guerrilla concentration zones on their territories. More than anything, though, they're upset that the Colombian government has hardly even discussed the idea with them. Here's Elmer Eduardo Quiñones, an Afro-Colombian community leader from Tumaco, a very conflictive area on the Pacific in Colombia's far southwest corner.
The Colombian state, through the Constitutional Court, has recognized that ethnic groups have been the most affected by the conflict, Afro-descendants in particular. However, despite how badly we've been affected, we've seen that all of our participation in the process has been completely nullified. We fear this process in terms of the absence of participation because a large part of the confrontation developed in our ancestral and collective territories. So for us, participation is more than necessary.
Afro-Colombian communities, organized in a network called CONPA, the Afro-Colombian Peace Council, say that their repeated requests for a meeting with government and guerrilla negotiators just to discuss what's going to happen in their territories have been refused. Todd Howland is the director of the UN High Commissioner for Human Rights Field Office in Bogota.
It's really important to look at how do the people most affected by the conflict participate and participate in this process, because they can't simply be objects of the peace process. You have, for example, the Afro-Colombian communities. You have the indigenous Colombians who to a large degree live in the rural area, perhaps even, maybe even 50% of the conflict or more is in the territories of Afro and indigenous Colombians. And so you need to have this participation. It's just like anything. You know, it's like you want to change your management structure. You want to change a vision. You need to talk to the people most affected. And those are the people that live in these territories where you had the conflict. And so there needs to be this change in terms of how do we actually bring this peace, you know, the peace process, which is really advanced politically and conceptually at an intellectual level, how do we bring this down and have people actually participate to know what it's about and to actually say, look, this might work, this might not work, because who knows their territories more than any one of the people that live there.
Another issue is security, really more generally. If you concentrate FARC fighters in specific zones around the country, and if they start to disarm, then you've dramatically altered the balance of power between violent groups in Colombia. Some fundamental equilibria will change. It's possible that the period immediately following a ceasefire could be more violent than what we're seeing now. Here's the commander of U.S. Southern Command, General John Kelly, speaking in January, just a few days before he retired.
And I think, with all due, I hope I'm not out of line to suggest something to the Colombian people, and that is the peace dividend is not going to be immediate. It will be there, but it's not going to be immediate. And the idea that once the peace treaty is over, then everyone, you know, the lambs lie down with the lions, it's not going to happen.
Okay, the lambs won't lie down with the lions because there are other lions out there in Colombia. Ariel Avila warns about a possible massacre of ex-FARC members.
The first challenge is security. More than just the FARC, Colombia has groups like the ELN or other organized crime groups like the Urabeños, Clan Usuga, Los Rastrojos, that have the capability to reclaim the territories that the FARC are going to leave once the concentration begins. In this takeover process, there could be a massacre of FARC members or an increase in violence in these communities.
Now, first, there's another guerrilla group that is just as old as the FARC, founded in the mid-1960s, although it's much smaller than the FARC. The ELN, National Liberation Army, has less than 2,000 fighters in a few parts of the country. Its leaders have been talking to the Colombian government for over 2 years now about how to get formal peace negotiations started. These talks are not going well right now. The ELN has been showing signs of being more active lately on the battlefield. It's carried out more attacks, including some in areas of longtime FARC influence. And it's captured some soldiers and police. Now, the ELN could generate violence after a FARC ceasefire, both by trying to move into longtime FARC zones or by recruiting FARC fighters who, in fact, decide personally that they don't want to demobilize. To avoid this, Ariel says that the ELN have to be brought into the bilateral ceasefire early, now, with UN verification, even before they've actually started negotiating the items on their agenda.
The UN verification mechanism for the ceasefire and disarmament agreements with the FARC serve as ways to reach a bilateral ceasefire between the ELN and the government. That guarantees that the ELN won't violate the bilateral ceasefire, and it avoids a massacre of the FARC by the ELN.
Now, on the other side from the ELN are paramilitary groups, which appear to be surging lately. Now, this is a phenomenon that keeps popping up in Colombia. We're talking about militias put together by narco traffickers, large landowners, some regional politicians, political bosses, and often with help from corrupt members of the military and police. They call themselves self-defense groups, defending themselves against the guerrillas, but for the most part, they're engaged in narco trafficking and other illegal ways of making money. Still, at the same time, they also pose the biggest threat to human rights defenders, journalists, land rights activists, labor leaders, and others who may want to change the status quo in Colombia. The biggest paramilitary confederation, the United Self-Defense Forces of Colombia, or AUC, killed three times as many people as the guerrillas during its peak period in the late 1990s and early 2000s. They got so bad they were even added to this U.S. State Department's terrorist list on September 10, 2001. A lot of old mid-level AUC leaders have banded with narco-traffickers to form a new set of regional armies who, taken together, have maybe 4,000 people in arms all around the country. Colombia's government calls these groups bandas criminales, criminal bands, or BACRIM for short. Many analysts, though, worry that this makes them sound just like some sort of nuisance, like they're bandits in the countryside, when actually there's something much more, something that can threaten Colombia's transition to post-conflict peace. Here's Danilo Rueda of Justicia y Paz, one of Colombia's most prominent human rights groups.
Lamentablemente, el paramilitarismo persiste en Colombia, aunque...
Regrettably, paramilitarism persists in Colombia, although the government uses the expression BACRIM to refer to criminal bands that don't have political objectives. And yes, we can affirm that the development of these armed operations continue to develop with complicity and tolerance of armed forces and police in diverse regions of the country. We believe that this institutional or para-institutional operational logic significantly affects the possibility of consolidation of the agreement that they are trying to reach with the FARC and eventually with the ELN. Civilians continue to be affected by these armed operations that seek to extort social and territorial control over their lives, their ways of life, and to extort them.
Extorsiones.
Now, to the ELN and the paramilitaries, add the likely scenario that some FARC members won't really abandon criminality, especially mid-level leaders who are right now active in the drug trade or in illegal mining. They may go through the motions of demobilization, and they may no longer call themselves FARC, but the lure of illegal money may be too great for some of them. Add also the likelihood of right-wing political spoilers, whether aligned to the paramilitaries or just people acting on their own, who may attack demobilized guerrilla leaders before they can form a nonviolent political movement. This has happened before in Colombia during peace processes in the 1980s and 1990s, when leaders of both the FARC, when they were trying to form a political party, as well as members of the M19 guerrilla group, were killed during key moments. Also, simply add the plain fact that Colombia's government may not have the capacity to fill the security vacuum in dozens of regions of the country where it has really never had a meaningful presence. Colombia has 1,100 municipalities or counties. Of these, the United Nations has identified 125 where government presence is so weak that only an enormous post-conflict effort can prevent them from falling into violence. The Peace and Reconciliation Foundation did its own study looking at illegal activity and several measures of basic government presence, and they came up with 281 municipalities, about a quarter of the country, where governance is a huge issue.
These are areas that are very hard to govern. They're vast and only sparsely populated, which is why it's been relatively easy to make a living there doing illegal things like growing coca, smuggling cocaine, cutting down forests, or mining precious metals. If the FARC truly vacates vast areas of Colombia's Pacific coasts, its southern jungles, its eastern plains, the Venezuelan border, can the government move into all of them at once? And if it doesn't, will there be a violent free-for-all as criminal groups compete to fill the power vacuum that the FARC leaves behind? There's already some concern that the Colombian government's control of territory is slipping somewhat. In addition to the more active ELN and paramilitaries, the U.S. government measured 159,000 hectares, about 650 square miles, of Colombian territory planted with coca bushes last year. That's the third highest single-year total ever. Meanwhile, the past month has seen a horrifying increase in attacks on human rights defenders. 16 have been killed since late February. That's an increase from roughly one a week to more than four per week. Most of those murders have happened in rural areas or in marginal urban slums. The message here is that if the government can't protect these people, how will it protect demobilized guerrillas? Here's Todd Howland from the UN Human Rights Office.
You have resistance on many sectors within society about the peace process. And we've had a number of peace advocates that have been threatened. Some of the victims, for example, that have gone to Havana to actually ask for the two parties to take seriously their rights have been threatened. And so we have a big problem in Colombia in that this issue in terms of sustainability, this issue in terms of how do you maximize democratic space in the context of this of the peace accord, one has to be realistic that the peace accord can actually produce huge change, but that change comes from people and people that are activists that push for change. It's the same in the States. It's the same everywhere. And so when people are pushing for change in Colombia, sometimes there's a pushback, and that pushback can be dangerous.
And again, some of those most susceptible to that pushback are Afro-Colombian and indigenous leaders. Marina Cordova is from AfroIS, an umbrella organization of internally displaced Afro-Colombian groups. He is also a member of CONPA. He says the communities he represents are very threatened and still fighting to be heard.
There's something important here. Look at the implementation of the agreements from different perspectives, from the point of view of the guerrillas who relinquish their arms and convert to a political movement, from the point of view of the traditional political parties, and from the point of view of economic interests. Each one here has a view of these communities, but these people are not strong enough to be able to defend their own proposals, their own life projects. Here, they need the international community to play a leadership role with their communities and organizations to find what are the most appropriate proposals and how to strengthen and to support them. But I'm fearful. I'm fearful that the international resources that are channeled through the national government are not going to get used to strengthen their autonomy or their organizational processes.
If Colombia can't protect vulnerable communities and human rights defenders, the FARC must surely wonder whether they're going to be protected once they give up their weapons. How can the Colombian government create some credible security guarantees, especially during what could be a very tense period after a ceasefire is in place? RL Avila suggests a combination of elite security force units and local community structures.
What we're sort of calling a ninth division of the army could be created, made up of those who have the most training in human rights. They would operate in those 281 municipalities. We're talking about Colombia having 1,102 municipalities total, and of those, 281 require this temporary arrangement. And finally, this is probably the most complex part, is that in the territories, there are communal protection mechanisms, rural campesino guards, indigenous guards, cimarron guards for the black communities. There are some cases of rural organizations, community action boards, to strengthen and obviously to oversee these community organizations. And all of this must be anchored in an early warning system, which is already run by the Ombudsman's Office. This needs to be much more ambitious, though, to verify and avoid what could happen in certain situations. There are many risks.
More physical protection is important, but simply deputizing more bodyguards won't guarantee security in these zones. One of the greatest obstacles to protecting people are the persistent ties between organized crime and Colombia's government, especially at the local level. Todd Howland cites Colombia's massive illegal mining industry as a prime example.
The reality of the country is one where violence is still very much part of the political culture, and that it's important, again, that this is an opportunity to overcome what has been a link between paramilitary groups, post-paramilitary groups, people within politics, and people within the armed forces. Corruption and connection still exists here in Colombia. And that this is a reality because, for example, how many of the illegal mines exist in Colombia? These illegal mines are identified by many NGOs, many environmental protection watchdog organizations. People know where these mines are. And these mines have these huge machines. These huge machines have had to pass through some kind of political filter and some kind of armed forces roadblocks in order to get there. And people know where they are because they're actually destroying the environment. They're putting mercury into the water. They're creating all sorts of health problems. And this continues to today because of that problem of the connection between illegality and the state. Again, this is an opportunity to help Colombia overcome a problem that, you know, over time has been dealt with but still exists.
Whatever you want to call it, paramilitaries, mafias, guerrilla remnants, breaking organized crime's links to the government should be at the center of any plan to secure and protect Colombians after a ceasefire. Central to that is a functioning justice system in rural areas. Now, that's something we at WOLA didn't hear enough people talking about lately on our trip to Colombia or in a recent reading of the media in Colombia. Ariel Avila sees another ingredient. He sees international oversight as essential to this and to the implementation of peace accords in general. Somebody outside Colombia, he says, needs to be watching.
The role of the international community in the post-conflict, in addition to financing and helping construct highways and hospitals, of course this must be done, but the principal role is serving as a guarantor and overseer to make sure that the agreements will be implemented. The FARC and the government already understand this, but this is their main role. I'm not sure this is going to be achieved, and I'm not sure the international community has this clear. It's not just sending money to build schools. What we need, for example, is that they are part of the big plan, that foundations like WOLA come to Colombia to visit the territories after they sign the peace agreements. They should come once a month, once every 45 days, and produce reports. Amnesty International should return to the country. The UN Human Rights Office must not go away, like the national government wants it to.
The international role will be important for more than just protecting vulnerable populations and human rights defenders. It'll be important for protecting Colombians all over who are working, even after a final peace accord is signed, to guarantee that the accord's implementation really benefits the people who the conflict hit the hardest. Diego Grueso, an Afro-Colombian leader from the Pacific port city of Buenaventura, worries that a poorly implemented peace deal could end up opening the door to massive, unscrupulous economic projects. These, in turn, could displace existing populations and end up worsening the conditions that caused the conflict in the first place.
So there are consequences of the post-conflict and of the negotiations. What the transition will do is encourage larger investments in parts of the economy and in these larger projects. What it fails to do is connect the people. It does not include that population in this development and excludes them from participation in strong institutions that allow them to counteract the project's environmental and social effects. The rights of the people of Buenaventura will remain the same, or even worsen.
Again, just like in the case of protecting ex-combatants, international involvement and oversight will be crucial to ensure that Colombians in conflict zones really see the benefits of a peace deal. Sister Soyla Cueto works with the Faith and Joy Movement, a Jesuit peace-building organization serving some of Colombia's most vulnerable populations.
The international community plays an important role. I think it should keep going and strengthen its support, economic support, support that doesn't necessarily have to pass through the government, support that should actually reach the communities. Because I feel that often the support that the international community provides stays at the governmental level, and the community's situations continue to worsen. It's necessary that this support have an ethnic focus, a focus on women, a focus on adolescents and children, and a focus on people with disabilities.
So in our survey of what could come up in Colombia's immediate post-conflict period, what are some things that came up? You just heard a lot of them. Involve the international community in overseeing the peace accord. Break the ties that still exist between organized crime and elements of the government. Credibly protect human rights defenders and other vulnerable groups. Include Afro-Colombian and indigenous communities in discussions of the concentration zones. We kept hearing this over and over in our discussions of what to expect after a ceasefire. And to be honest, it's hard to imagine a smooth transition without a big effort underway in all of those areas. Wola wishes to thank everyone who spoke to us about these issues when we spent the first week of March in Bogota, and we wish to thank you for listening once again to the Wola podcast. We'll be back soon. Please join us then.